This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
This is the Marketplace Morning Report from APM. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland.
It's Marketplace Tech Report from APM, American Public Media. I'm John Moe.
Welcome to Payday, a special podcast from Marketplace exploring the mystery of what we get paid in America. I'm David Brancaccio. Stay with us to learn about how talking about compensation may be the last taboo in America. I'll talk to an IBM retiree who came up with an innovation to keep tabs on great big executive pay packages. An expert has a piece of advice on how to maximize your paycheck. We'll look at pay at the bottom of the wage scale. And come to a dinner party that mixes paychecks, nudity, and I believe they're also serving deviled eggs. Payday, the podcast, part of Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty series.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
I dare you. The next friend or coworker you see, fess up and tell them how much you get paid. Couldn't do it, could you? It's as taboo a subject as you can get in America. Many people will talk about their sex lives before they'll talk about the size of their paycheck. But there are exceptions, including a Colorado company that is an extreme exception.
Yes, we have what I like to call extreme transparency.
Amanda Bybee is the VP at Namaste Solar in Boulder. There's a lot of sunshine going on inside this solar power installation company. Every employee can see a spreadsheet listing what everybody else makes. Terry Lima, an accountant, looks at it all the time and sees quite a few folks paid more.
I don't feel shortchanged in any way. I also am grateful to know there's no backdoor deals, that I don't have to do some political something so that I can make more money for myself.
And Namaste is extreme in other ways. It's employee-owned. Every worker, including Surendra Tapa, the forklift driver, is privy to all the company's financials, including every permanent employee's pay rate. Given this culture, I figured people like Amanda Bybee, the VP, would tell me this transparency about salaries is all sweetness and light. But no.
I have a colleague who's making a little less than me, who comes to me and says, I don't think you deserve more than I am making. And we're talking a difference of $1,000 a year.
They worked it out and are buddies again. But CEO Blake Jones acknowledges these conversations are uncomfortable.
But it's worth having it be out in the open. It's worth facing the fears that you might have of talking about it.
Being clear on salaries makes good business sense, Jones says. It builds trust and also makes coworkers accountable. They notice if someone's getting paid to goof off. But the transparency is for inside the company. Tellingly, neither Jones nor Bybee talks about their pay rate outside the company.
The taboo around money may be our last standing taboo.
New York University financial sociologist Kate Zaloom says this explains one of the great mysteries. How is it that given wide gaps in income in America, everybody walks around thinking we're so equal?
Of course, everyone in America thinks that they're middle class, but the only way that someone who makes $12,000 a year and someone who makes $200,000 a year can assume that they are all in the same social category is by never actually revealing what they make to each other.
It's not just a social taboo. Many employers enforce this.
I am, in fact, prohibited from telling anyone how much I make contractually.
Had Zaloom worked not for NYU, but for the University of California, we could look up her pay ourselves. The Sacramento Bee newspaper was able to put the salaries of California state employees onto a website for all to see. How's that make the workers feel, employees like UC Berkeley professor David Card?
I'm a labor economist, and for labor economists, we're always analyzing salaries. And so it's possible that I may be desensitized.
So, Professor Card, how much do you make?
My salary from the university is around $300,000 a year.
Wow, you didn't hesitate.
Well, you can look it up on the internet.
Card studied the effect of the salary website and found that fellow employees who noticed they were doing better than the average golden bear kind of shrugged. But people who were doing worse than their peers tended to be really upset.
Yeah, that's true. And that might be one of the reasons why many employers insist on pay secrecy as part of the deal of working there. And it's going to really make the lower wage people much less happy.
Yeah, my name is Marie Cruz Manzanares, and I'm senior custodian at UC Berkeley.
A custodian with more than 12 years' experience. She also now sits on the board of her service employees' union local. Together, we typed the salary website into my iPad. What does it say you're paid?
$34,493.10.
The pay is obviously no surprise for Manzanares, but as that $34,000 sits there, stark on the webpage, she thinks of her three children and how that salary doesn't leave much left over to pay for their college.
And how can I ask my kids to put more into something that me as a mother cannot even help them with?
But she sees there is power in getting salaries out into the open. Her union has used the website to prepare for contract negotiations.
Actually, it's good that somebody put this website out there so we can check. If we put Mr. Yudov's name in there, it'll show up.
Who?
The president of the university system, Yudov, Mark Yudov. Let's see.
What does it say?
$560,594.40.
So over $500,000.
This is only for him and his wife. My salary still have to be for my three children and me. So that's ridiculous.
Which gets us to the case of executive salaries. There's one group of people who are not supposed to keep their compensation secret, company bosses. But now Congress is demanding companies go further and compare CEO pay to what everyone else makes at a company. This has sparked a fiery controversy that seems to have touched everyone in the corporate sector except for the man who helped dream up the idea. It's a story of an idea that took decades to formulate and percolate. It took so long that you have to adjust for inflation. When James Cotton says millions, think tens of millions.
You're working with this guy, and he seems to be pretty intelligent, but dang, he doesn't look like he's worth $2 million a year.
Cotton is now 72, but in the 1970s, he was a corporate lawyer at IBM, where he dealt with financial statements. So in an occupation full of price-to-earnings ratios.
That's how it really got started in my head.
Cotton came up with his own ratio. Take the CEO's compensation and divide by the average of everyone else's pay at the company. If the CEO makes $20 million a year and everyone else averages $100,000, then that's a 200-to-1 ratio. The bigger the ratio, the wider the gulf between the boss and everyone else.
The top executives earn a significant amount of money, and they're people who are manufacturing the actual machine that's providing this money and are not making nearly as much money. And I thought about it, and I said, you know, there's something wrong with this situation.
It was Cotton's thought that the government should force public companies to calculate and report this ratio. He later left IBM to become a law professor at Texas Southern. In 1997, he published his case for a pay ratio in a law review, hoping it would attract attention.
And maybe somebody would pick it up and see the significance of it. And nobody did until you came along.
Well, wait, I want to understand this. So, like, I'm the first guy to call about this?
Yeah.
I had called bearing the news that 2 years ago, Congress put a ratio very much like Cotton's into the big financial reform law called Dodd-Frank.
You know, I keep track of financial business and stuff. You have to remember, I have this low vision. I'm legally blind, so it's very hard to read things. But that is great news if it's actually in the statute.
It is, but I have to temper that news with the fact that the SEC has been taking a while to try to implement this ratio because companies are very resistant to this.
Yes, I know how resistant they are.
So until the Securities and Exchange Commission determines the rules, public companies don't have to cough up the ratio, law or no law.
Yeah, the companies went ape over that.
Nell Minow at GMI Ratings is a fierce critic of outsized CEO pay. She says companies are terrified they'll get ranked and the ones with the biggest gap will face public shame. So there's a fight, in part, about how to do the calculation.
What I think is hilarious is these people who keep telling you how much they know about finances and numbers have been arguing that they don't know how to do the math to get the answer on that.
Bill George, the former CEO of Medtronic, is now at the Harvard Business School. He's also on the boards of several companies you've heard of, including Goldman Sachs and ExxonMobil. He says a wide gulf between the pay of the CEO and everyone else can sow internal tension, which can hobble a company.
And if it gets out of alignment where all of a sudden a CEO is making huge multiples of what everyone else is, then you start to lose trust.
But he believes pay ratios are unfair because they make certain kinds of companies look bad for reasons that may have nothing to do with an overpaid boss. A supermarket chain might have an alarming-looking ratio because it's comparing the CEO to all the low-wage checkout clerks typical of this sort of company.
I think it's very hard to legislate compensation. I don't think that's going to get there.
Instead, he says you keep executive pay in line by getting the board of directors to stand up to the boss, which doesn't always happen.
And a lot of people just back off to the CEO and let the CEO influence compensation, and that's wrong.
And the difference between the CEOs and everybody else is that the CEOs pick the people who set their pay.
Nell Minow says, look around a boardroom when that pay is on the table.
We'll see. There's the CEO's golf buddy. There's the guy who's on the charitable board with him. These are not exactly arm's-length transactions, or if they are, the arms are very, very short.
But some experts on how to pay the boss say this is changing. Robin Farrakhan is a veteran compensation consultant at Farrant Advisors. I asked her about board members feeling pressure from CEOs for bigger pay packages than can be justified.
Well, I think that's changing. I think it probably, I'm not sure it was the norm 10 years ago, but it might have been a common circumstance. I think these days one has to differentiate being collaborative from being complicit. To me, being collaborative means you're trying to work with the company and work with the other players on the team to bring the right result to the table for shareholders. Complicit means you're in cahoots with somebody to try to get an outcome for the person, I think. And so that's a very key distinction. With regard to comp committees these days, they have been given a lot of power to help pick their advisors, to be independent. There's a requirement now that they have to be independent. They have to warrant that their advisors are independent. And so they're given a lot of backbone, if you will, to help stand up to any executive if that's what's needed. But in the spirit of that, everybody's trying to work for the shareholders. So you're trying to collaborate, come up with a solution that serves the shareholders best. And having the executives upset, annoyed, angry usually isn't helping the cause for the shareholders either. On the other hand, just giving in might not help either. So that's where the fine line is.
What do you do as a consultant about pressure from senior management when you're trying to come up with a recommendation on what to pay them?
So people on the radio really can't see me, but I'm 5'1" tall, and I like to say I used to be six feet tall, and I've been beaten down to this size over the years because it's hard. You have to stand up for it, and I've just philosophically taken the approach that long run, it's going to be my job to be objective. That's how I build reputation. That's how I can live with myself. That's how I can sleep at night. And that's the standard I hold myself to.
Now, Robin, when you start to answer that question, your cheeks actually flushed. I'm imagining that you're recalling incidents where, some CEO is pounding on the table wanting you to up his pay package.
Oh, yes. I have been called names. I have had CEOs pound on the table. I've had my work maligned. But in the end, I know my work's good. We stand by it.
Compensation consultant Robin Farrakhan's book is called Fair Pay, Fair Play, Aligning Executive Performance and Pay. If you're lucky enough to be employed in this economy, take a moment now to picture your own paycheck. It's one of the most important numbers for any of us, right after the word net on the pay stub. But where does that number come from? There's often a hidden system at work shaping your compensation that could stand in the way of your next raise if you don't know how to play it. Take, for instance, Yelena Schur. When it came to negotiating her first big job after college, Yelena did everything right, almost everything. Her only mistake was last Thanksgiving when a relative got her to crack.
It was my aunt. She is quite blunt, to say the least.
Yelena was about to graduate from Cornell's School of Industrial and Labor Relations and already had what she considered a great job lined up in her chosen field of human resources. But under cross-examination, Yelena broke the great American taboo.
And she asked me how much I'm making, and it was kind of just silent at the table. And meanwhile, my mom was kind of shaking her head, telling me not to tell her. And when I told my aunt what I make, her reaction was, oh, so little? Well, that's okay. I mean, in a few years, you'll have a raise.
Ouch.
Yes.
She won't make that mistake again. But here's what Yelena got right. At Cornell, she had studied the mysteries of how companies are supposed to set pay.
There's a whole bunch of number crunching that goes into it by like looking at what competitors pay and what a certain job is valued within a company.
Modern organizations try to get systematic about paychecks. So when it came to her own job search, Yelena knew how to use this system and came up with a salary goal of
$50,000, between $50,000 and $55,000.
When a prominent business consulting firm in Manhattan offered a sweet human resources job, the salary was right on the money. Yelena still tried some negotiating and brought up maybe a relocation bonus. The company said, nah, since she was moving just a few subway stops from Brooklyn to Manhattan. But it's clear Yelena never did have much room to maneuver. You see, the job for which she was applying was a pretty clear-cut position, entry-level human resources. Economist Kevin Halleck was Yelena's professor at Cornell.
If it's a very specific skill set and a very specific task that's being done, I think it's more straightforward to pay the person.
The science starts with a little business you may never have heard of. There are outfits that conduct salary surveys, persuading employers to report what they pay you. No names, but listed by the kind of work you do. Companies can then buy the finished survey to reality check their own salaries. And why would your company even fill out the survey? Well, there's often a sweet discount price for the finished salary listings for companies that contributed their own pay rates in the first place. Some websites also buy this paycheck data and put it online so the rest of us can have what the employer has already.
Now you can negotiate both of you being educated.
Zahir Ladani, the president of Salary.com, says it's like when the real cost of new cars hit the web some years ago.
You go and buy your car, you go to Kelley Blue Book or any other places you can do. In the same way, with Salary.com, can we get people educated on what that salary is being benchmarked at and how you could grow that?
All this data at play sounds scientific, but here's a revelation from Halleck. Even in the best-run companies, figuring out what to pay people is not just a formula.
I think it's part science and it's part art.
If a job in, for instance, human resources is easy to compare, like, oh, I don't know, a pork belly trading on a commodities market, then a company will know what to pay. But America's workforce is changing, and increasingly, job descriptions are no longer standardized or run-of-the-mill.
In today's economies, some occupations are pretty hard to define. And if it's an occupation that's not common and one that's not used by many others, things are a lot more difficult.
So many jobs are hybrids, like a graphic designer slash marketing consultant, or they're limited edition positions, like the one guy who knows how to keep the machinery going at the Hoover Dam. These are jobs that are more artisanal, handcrafted, less pork belly and more, what should we say, more gourmet sausage. And the more gourmet sausage the job, the less scientific the pay calculation gets. In place of science, the art of negotiation comes in.
It's an incredibly important point for thinking about how to get paid more.
And how do you prep for that negotiation? Halleck has a book coming out in a couple weeks called Pay: Why People Earn What They Earn. He says never walk into a big job meeting without doing this crucial piece of homework.
If an employee can figure out what's important to the organization, what's the organization trying to do? If the employee can make his or herself look useful to that mission, he or she can help themselves in negotiation.
Advice from Cornell professor Kevin Halleck. Now let's go to the bottom of the paycheck ladder for a closer look at the minimum wage. That's the pay scale for more than 1 in 20 workers in America. Recently, congressional Democrats introduced a bill that would raise the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $9.80 over the next 2 years. It's not expected to make much headway this year, but it has some people talking about the pros and cons of the idea. Wealth and Poverty reporter Chrissy Clark took two economists to the heart of minimum wage country to have them hash it out.
To get to minimum wage country, I didn't have to go far.
I'm at the Pizza Hut.
What?
I'm at the Taco Bell.
What?
I'm at the combination Pizza Hut and Taco Bell.
The kind of funny-sounding fast food hybrid that's the subject of this definitely funny song happens to be owned by one of the largest employers of minimum wage workers in the country, Yum Brands Incorporated is the parent company of
Pizza Hut
and
Taco Bell. What?
Its U.S. workforce is more than 800,000 strong.
Hey, you ready to order?
Yeah.
Including Liz, according to her name tag.
Can I have the Cinnabon Delights?
She took my order at the combination Pizza Hut and Taco Bell near my house in L.A.
Anything else for you?
I asked the restaurant supervisor what the starting hourly rate is for a job like Liz's.
For a regular team member, it's a minimum wage.
Which, at current levels, means that if Liz was supporting a family of three, she'd be below the poverty line. Now, Taco Bell says they pay competitive salaries and provide training so people like Liz can move up. But what would happen to Liz, to her customers, to this Pizza Hut Taco Bell's bottom line if the minimum wage was raised? I invited two people who think a lot about that kind of question.
Hi, Bob. Hi, Chrissy.
But see it in very different lights.
Hi, David. Chrissy.
To, through the magic of radio, come join me at this Pizza Hut and Taco Bell for a little minimum wage throwdown. In one corner, we have Bob Polin, an economist at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. I asked him for his order.
Have a burrito.
And for his basic perspective on the minimum wage.
We should have a minimum wage that enables everybody, including all the people at the Pizza Hut and Taco Bell, to lead a minimally decent life.
In the other corner is David Newmark, an economist at the University of California, Irvine.
I don't like the idea that people who work live below poverty conditions or even somewhat above poverty conditions. I think the question is, does a minimum wage actually help?
And his order?
Since this is an invisible meal and I'm not eating it, I'll take a large pepperoni pizza and an extra large Coke.
And in fact, David says one of his main concerns about raising minimum wage is actually illustrated by Liz the cashier's response when I order that extra large Coke. She says this.
I'm going to give you the Coke.
And points to a self-serve drink dispenser.
You could take whatever you want.
Okay.
Turns out this moment, David says, is quite possibly an effect of past increases in the minimum wage.
When I was a kid and you ordered soda, a person had to stand there with a finger on the button until the glass filled up. And now in many of the fast food restaurants, of course, they've completely eliminated any labor involved with pouring the soda.
And soda by soda, that can add up to eliminating a job.
And minimum wages can accelerate these kind of changes.
Because, David argues, if a company has to pay people more, they'll find ways to pay fewer people. If we raise the minimum wage today and came back to this Pizza Hut Taco Bell in 6 months?
My prediction, based on lots and lots of research, is that there'd be somewhat less employment at that restaurant.
Of course, David cautioned.
Economists have been wrong once or twice before about their theories.
Not you, though.
At this point, Bob, the other economist, couldn't help himself. He had to jump in. First of all, Bob pointed out, the academic research is split on whether raising the minimum wage actually raises unemployment in any significant way. For one thing, he says, there are alternative ways a fast food joint might offset the extra costs of higher wages.
The prices of the products could go up, and you will also see some reduction in the profits of the business owners.
And he says you can't ignore all the good things a minimum wage bump can do for the workers themselves. Bob surveyed nearly 100 people who've been affected by past minimum wage increases. He asked what changed in their lives.
You don't have to work three jobs. You only have to work two jobs. Or they can get a car, a used car. They can at least get their car repaired. They can buy groceries for elderly parents. Those are meaningful things.
And Bob argues, because businesses are investing more money in their workers, turnover tends to drop, too.
You get people operating at a higher level of productivity. That improves relations between managers and workers. You essentially change the nature of the work relationship when you pay people decently.
Bob and David sparred a bit more over raising the minimum wage. Bob pointed out that if you adjust for inflation, minimum wage is actually lower now than it was 40 years ago. David asked, who really benefits from a higher minimum wage? Poor families or the many middle-class teenagers who work low-wage part-time jobs? One of the few things they could both agree on about minimum wage?
It is not a cure-all to poverty. In fact, the biggest source of low-income poverty is the fact that people don't have jobs at all.
I absolutely agree with that.
Finally, some consensus.
Okay.
I asked Liz, the woman behind the Pizza Hut Taco Bell counter, what she thought about all this, but she couldn't talk. She was on the clock. As for David and Bob, they were, of course, in different parts of the country, so they couldn't actually eat the pizza and burrito they'd ordered through the magic of radio. But I could.
Okay, for your 2 minutes.
For here.
I'm Chrissy Clark. from Marketplace.
There you go.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And this is a good time to get Chrissy Clark out of the cold and into the studio to talk a bit more about the minimum wage. Hello, Chrissy.
Hi, David.
Now, you say there's another issue that gets debated a lot in terms of the pros and cons of putting up the minimum wage. You touched on it a little bit in the piece, but what are you talking about?
Yeah, well, rather than me explain it, first let's just take a listen to this Taco Bell hiring video.
My Taco Bell gives me a flexible schedule.
The restaurant can just go ahead and work around my school schedule anytime.
I have, you know, baseball practice, I go to the gym.
So notice how young those voices sound?
Yes, very student-like.
Yes, and in fact, some of them talk about school and baseball practice, things like that. So David Newmark, one of the economists in my piece, says that the other thing that you have to think about if you raise the minimum wage is who would be getting that raise, and that would be a lot of teenagers. It turns out that teenagers are disproportionately represented in the minimum wage workforce. And these aren't necessarily teenagers from just poor families. They're kids from middle-class families who don't really need an increase at all. Newmark refers to this as the problem of leakage, which is kind of a gross term. But what he means is some of the benefits of a minimum wage raise would leak out to higher income families as opposed to lower income families that the minimum wage is theoretically supposed to help.
All right. Interesting point. But what's the argument against that?
Well, Bob Polin, the other economist that I spoke to during the piece, says there aren't enough of those teenagers to make the minimum wage totally moot. He says only about 10% of the workers who'd be affected by an increase in the minimum wage are teenagers. And in fact, the median family income for people who'd be affected by a proposed minimum wage increase is $34,000, which is definitely above the poverty line, but it's still also definitely on the lower end of the income spectrum.
All right. Fascinating stuff. Chrissy Clark from the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk. I really appreciate this.
Thanks, David.
Now, the embedded assumption about pay is that we all want more of it. After all, whoever asks the boss for a decrease, right? But there's research suggesting that beyond a point, a bigger paycheck is not always better. Recently, some folks in the Pacific Northwest gathered to look at what they really want out of their paychecks. And you got to love this kind of dinner party, nudity and salary all in one.
I was thinking about you all coming tonight, and it was almost like imagining that we were all going to get naked together. You know?
And that is a priest talking.
And I was thinking, gosh, am I actually going to do it? Am I actually going to share what I make?
Jennifer Cresswell, Episcopal priest in Portland, Oregon, and her husband Ian Desher, who works in marketing, have invited four friends on a summer night to see if anyone might bear their salary. We'd asked our audience via our Public Insight Network about salary and happiness. Cresswell wrote back saying she'd often, quote, fantasized about inviting friends over to talk about how much they make and their priorities for spending, sharing, saving, which sounded like a fine idea.
I've been broke for a long time. I learned how to live broke, you know, in my early
20s. We're really good at broke.
I was great at it, you know. I mean,
Ryan McCauley works at a boys and girls club. His wife, Shanna, is a second Episcopal priest here. We'd sent a link to a Princeton study that found that more money doesn't make you happier once household income hits $75,000 a year. It's when that 75K comes up that Shanna and Ryan become the first couple to bear their paychecks.
That much, actually. We together make just under 65. I did it! I broke the barrier! I feel like we're pretty low middle class. I mean, we're middle class because we have expendable income, but we were just going through our bills and it doesn't look good.
We're high low class.
A lot of clergy here. Jenny Ott is a pastor at the United Church of Christ. She reveals her household income is $57,800 while her partner Hillary is in graduate school.
It would be nice if we had more. It would be nice if we could just, I don't know if it's 75 is going to be the magic number or what, but we have enough.
Kinda, just barely.
It's been nice to also live off of the generosity of friends like you guys who have said, hey, we have storage for you so you don't have to pay $150 a month for a storage unit while we live in 500 square feet trying to save money.
The Princeton study found that happiness peaks at $75,000 by studying people who'd been asked how happy were you yesterday? But that same study also looked at life satisfaction. And in that case, there was no upper limit. The bigger your income, the more satisfied you feel about your life as a whole. Dinner party hosts Jennifer and Ian say their compensation is rising, but they don't feel any more or less satisfied or happy.
We expand into our new salary really easily.
We've been hearing folks at the party thinking about income in terms of what it buys you. But experts say there is another way to think about it.
And then there's happiness with the salary, which is telling you about yourself and telling other people about you.
Daniel Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at Duke and author of Predictably Irrational.
The moment the amount becomes public, all of a sudden your happiness with your salary could be motivated by different things than your happiness with the amount of money that you actually need.
Because comparisons, if not envy, creep in. Ian starts thinking his paycheck should be bigger during boys' night out with his buddies, including one who's in tech, another a healthcare executive.
I pretty much assume that all of them make more than I do. I mean, I honestly think that hanging out with them more since we moved back to Portland was one of the things that made me think, like, I should be making more.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
You know.
And you should.
Wow.
Well, I realize we haven't yet shown ourselves naked. So,
I know we haven't.
So we probably make a combined about $106,000 mm-hmm. a year.
$71,000 for Ian, $35,000 for Jennifer's part-time work as a priest. To do the brutal math here, $106,000 a year is 63% more than the household income of Shanna and Ryan across the dinner table.
Well, I think it creates a little bit of separation, you know, knowing that you have more means than we do, and so we're not there yet. We have been trying to kick it together to buy a manufactured home, and like that's our big dream right now, and that seems like so far off. But on the other hand, I mean, it still makes you human. You're not superhuman. You're not making millions of dollars a year.
And to be clear, the typical income in America, the median, is less than $52,000. This year, when a polling firm looked at income and well-being, it found that when you get below that $50,000 level, happiness goes down the tubes. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace. I mentioned how we found Jennifer and her friends in Portland, Oregon, through our Public Insight Network. If you'd like to add your voice to the conversation about pay and what it means, go to marketplace.org and then search Naked Paycheck. You'll find the place for your comments toward the bottom of the page. Payday, the podcast, was produced by Chow Tu. The Wealth and Poverty Senior Editor is Celeste Wesson. I'm David Brancaccio. This is APM, American Public Media.